Part 8. Other Subsidies. Infrastructure and military spending are not the only examples of the process by which cost and risk are socialized and profit is privatized, or, as Rothbard put it, by which our corporate state uses the coercive taxing power either to accumulate corporate capital or to lower corporate costs. Some of these government assumptions of risk and cost are ad hoc and targeted toward specific industries. Among the greatest beneficiaries of such underwriting are electrical utilities. Close to 100% of all research and development for nuclear power is either performed by the government itself in its military reactor program or by lump sum R&D grants. The government waives use charges for nuclear fuels, subsidizes uranium production, provides access to government land below market price, and builds hundreds of miles of access roads at taxpayer expense, enriches uranium, and disposes of waste at sweetheart prices. The Price-Anderson Act of 1957 limited the liability of the nuclear power industry and assumed government liability above that level. A Westinghouse official admitted, in 1953, quote, "If you were to inquire whether Westinghouse might consider putting up its own money, we would have to say no. The cost of the plant would be a question mark until after we built it, and, by that sole means, we found out the answer. We would not be sure of successful plant operation until after we had done all the work and operated successfully. This is still a situation of pyramiding uncertainties. There is a distinction between risk-taking and recklessness." So much for profit as a reward for the entrepreneur's risk. These, quote, entrepreneurs make their profits in the same way as a 17th century courtier, by obtaining the favor of the king. To quote Chomsky, "The sectors of the economy that remain competitive are those that feed from the public trough. The glories of free enterprise provide a useful weapon against government policies that might benefit the general population. But the rich and the powerful have long appreciated the need to protect themselves from the destructive forces of free market capitalism, which may provide suitable themes for rousing oratory, but only so long as the public handout and the regulatory and protectionist apparatus are secure and state power is on call when needed." Duane Andreas, CEO of Archer Daniels Midland, admitted that, quote, "There is not one grain of anything in the world that is sold on the free market, not one. The only place you see a free market is in the speeches of politicians," unquote. Big business also enjoys financial support through the tax code. It is likely that most of the Fortune 500 would go bankrupt without corporate welfare. Direct federal tax breaks to business in 1996 were close to $350 billion. This figure, for federal corporate welfare alone, is over two-thirds of annual corporate profits for 1996, $460 billion. Estimates of state and local tax breaks is fairly impressionistic, since they vary not only with each critic's subjective definition of corporate welfare, but involve the tax codes of 50 states and the public records of thousands of municipalities. Besides, money pimps in the state and local governments are embarrassed by the sweet deals they give their corporate johns. In my own state of Arkansas, the incorruptible Baptist preacher who serves as governor opposed a bill to require quarterly public reports from the Department of Economic Development on its special tax breaks to businesses. Quote, "Keeping incentive records from public scrutiny is important in attracting business, and releasing proprietary information could have a chilling effect." But state and local corporate welfare could easily amount to a figure comparable to the federal. Taken as a whole, direct tax breaks to businesses at all levels of government are probably on the same order of magnitude as corporate profits. And this understates the effect of corporate welfare, since it disproportionately goes to a handful of giant firms in each industry. For example, accelerated depreciation favors expansion by existing firms. New firms find it of little benefit, since they are likely to lose money after their first few years. An established firm, however, can run a loss in a new venture and charge the accelerated depreciation against its profits on old facilities. The most outrageous of these tax expenditures is the subsidy to the actual financial transactions by which capital is concentrated. The interest deduction on corporate debt, most of which was run up on leveraged buyouts and acquisitions, costs the Treasury over $200 billion a year. Without the deduction, the wave of mergers in the 1980s or the mega-mergers of the 1990s could never have taken place. On top of everything else, this acts as a massive direct subsidy to banking, increasing the power of finance capital in the corporate economy to a level greater than it has been since the age of Morgan. A closely related subsidy is the exemption from capital gains of securities transactions involved in corporate mergers, i.e. stock swaps, even though premiums are usually paid well over the market value of the stock. The 1986 tax reform included a provision which prevented corporations from deducting fees for investment banks and advisors involved in leveraged buyouts. The 1996 minimum wage increase repealed this provision with one exception. Interest deductions were removed for employee buyouts. Right libertarians like Rothbard object to classifying tax expenditures as subsidies. It presumes that tax money rightfully belongs to the government, when in fact the government is only letting them keep what is rightfully theirs. The tax code is indeed unfair, but the solution is to eliminate the taxes for everyone, not to level up the code. This is a very shaky argument. Supporters of tax code reform in the 1980s insisted that the sole legitimate purpose of taxation was to raise revenue, not to provide carrots and sticks for social engineering purposes. And, semantic quibbling aside, the current tax system would be exactly the same if we started out with zero tax rates and then imposed a punitive tax only on those not engaged in favored activities. Either way, the uneven tax policy gives a competitive advantage to privileged industries.